First case on our calendar is 96-677 and 96-678, State of Ohio v. Kenneth Wayne Smith. Ms. McGarry.
In those 25 states, has this issue ever been taken up to the United States Supreme Court? Has it been challenged?
Not directly. The issue itself has been challenged and briefed, for example, in Arizona, there, where there is a similar process, and after the procedure had been in place for a long period of time, because they had always had the kind of process that we have currently. There did become an equal protection challenge. Their state, relying on profit, upheld the process of not violating equal protection. But in the process of making that determination, the court looked at not only the kinds of review that their Supreme Court provided to the death row inmates, which I would argue to say is very different than what we are left with here in our Supreme Court review, but they also had the fact that the reason that was given for their process was because it would ensure consistency among the death penalty cases that they were reviewed by only one court, their Supreme Court. That's not the procedure that has happened here. There's been no such argument there was no consistency in the death sentences in Ohio. The only reason it's ever been given for issue one is that we need to execute people faster.
Well, counsel, the history of the appellate process, it would seem to me it's not a particularly strong argument to retain it. We've done it this way for the last 200 years. Why shouldn't we continue? There is, it would seem, a real deficiency in the process, whether you like the process or not, and the time delays. I mean, is it not an axiom of criminal justice that there should not be an inordinate delay between the beginning of the process and the end of the process. And we have tremendous delay, which would undercut public confidence in the whole criminal justice system. I mean, that's, I assume, the argument that's advanced. And that's not just a political argument. Isn't that a fairly fundamental argument about the whole concept of punishment, is that punishment needs to be fairly swift and certain, or it has relatively no deterrent value?
I don't disagree with you, Your Honor, but the problem in this case is, first of all, the change is being exerted on persons who have not delayed the process. They are being sent towards people like Kennedy Smith and all of the issues on appellants that are now coming along when they had no part of the delay. So something that may have happened, and I don't know that I would concede that there is a delay in the process, but if there is,
a decade would seem to, I think, most reasonable people be due delay, would not.
I think if you look at the, and this is not a record, but if you look at the state procedures across the country, that is not an unreasonable period of time, it is a typical period of time.
Let me move to another part of the argument that you
Before you do, though, I would like to just follow up on Justice Papers' comments about delay, and I'm sure you've reviewed the materials on it, and is it really a delay in the intermediate appellate process and the appellate process for the Supreme Court, or is the delay really caused by what we used to have in post-conviction where a defendant had unlimited number of post-conviction? Isn't that where the real delay has been?
You make a very good point, and that procedure has been eliminated. The fact of the matter is that the executions in Ohio will be speeded up already because of the fact that we have the dual review system now. And interestingly enough, when the legislature was in the process of passing the change to the post-conviction statute, it was discussed at that time of again setting the death row inmate apart and having a separate procedure, either coming directly to this court or going just to the Court of Appeals without even a discretionary appeal to this court, and that was eliminated, or that never made it into the bill because they thought it would be a violation of equal protection.
Well, whether or not there's any delay is not a constitutional issue.
No, it is not.
As a matter of fact, the General Assembly has the power even to be unfair so long as it is not unconstitutional. How can a constitution be unconstitutional? And do you have any case where the 14th Amendment has been used to hold any provision of the Ohio Constitution, or for that matter, any other state, unconstitutional?
The recent case of Roe v. Dobbs of the United States Supreme Court, which was in a very similar posture in that their general population had voted a constitutional amendment. It was taken up in the United States Supreme Court as a violation of equal protection, and the United States Supreme Court did overturn that constitutional amendment as violating equal protection. And some of the interesting aspects of the Romer case are very applicable to us here. Some of the language from the Romer case concerning the fact that you just can't have this animus towards a particular group, that's never going to be a legitimate interest in trying to uphold something on a rational basis analysis. You're just going to try to separate us as a person and harm them in some certain way, which is what's happened here. And the other problem we have with the constitutional amendment, the change, is that we have additional requirements that we all have to be aware of pursuing the Eighth Amendment. We are entitled, pursuant to the Eighth Amendment, as a death row inmate to full and fair appellate review. And if this court cannot provide that full and fair appellate review, then it cannot meet the Eighth Amendment requirement.
Mr. Garrett, now that is a very good point, because really what is required, I'm sure you would agree, is a meaningful appellate review. And I think that your argument about the unconstitutionality of the constitutional amendment, isn't it really a matter of degree? You know, can you say that this review by this court is not a meaningful appellate review? Isn't that what you have to be saying?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's not. And the reasons why are because when we
legal issue here, whether or not this court can weigh, given the change to the Constitution, whether this court can weigh in death penalty cases now. Do you I know you argue that we cannot. The state argues that we can.
Your Honor, I look historically at how the court reviewed this issue. As far back as 1955, in State versus Robinson, this court said we do not have the constitutional power. And you have been always very consistent in the State versus Dewey case, the capital case, that even in a capital case, we cannot weigh the evidence.
And what has changed since then?
The only thing that has changed is that the legislature has tried to legitimize by putting into effect 2953 OC. The legislature cannot give this court constitutional power if the Constitution does not allow for it. So the legislature cannot try to make constitutional amendments meet the requirements of the 14th and the 8th Amendment by then belatedly putting in this enabling statute to say, okay, now you have the power to review weight of the evidence. When indeed, if you look at the language of the Constitution, the court is not given this power. This court has specifically held that power was given to the court of appeal. And this court has specifically, even as of 2 months ago, said we do not have the constitutional power to review weight of the evidence.
Have other defense counsel missed that point then? Because we've been doing that under 2953.02 and 05, which says we shall review and independently weigh the evidence of the death penalty. What's been missing here?
Weighing the evidence as it relates to whether or not the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors is a very different review than for me to say to the court, I want you to weigh, in my case, whether there is enough evidence to prove Kenny Smith guilty of these crimes or any other death penalty account that would come before you. And there have been occasions where the death penalty defendants have come before you and said, we want you, the court, to weigh this, weigh the evidence in this case, because we don't think it meets that level, doesn't meet the credibleness of the evidence to convict this person. And the court says, sorry, we can't do that. The Constitution doesn't give us that power.
There is nothing in the Constitution that expressly restricts that power, is there?
No,
as there is with the Court of Appeals.
My analysis comes from looking at Article 4, Section 2 and Article 4, Section 3, and realizing that that power is given to the Court of Appeals. No such similar power is given to this court. So by analysis, since it is left out, it's not given to the court.
Counsel, you advance what is a very appealing, strong argument here on this point. Can we mollify your concerns by determining that since the Constitution has been amended in this fashion to bypass appellate review at the Court of Appeals level, that we must necessarily exercise that power in reading the two constitutional provisions together, conclude that we have to do that. Does that solve that problem if we made such a conclusion?
It would solve the problem in the sense of it would give my client a review of the weight of the evidence, but what it would do in the process is you would be taking power that you have not been given by the legislature, and you would also be returning all of your previous precedent.
We've done that in the past. That has troubled me maybe less than others. And couldn't we conclude that impliedly the citizens of this state have directed us to arrive at such a conclusion for this type of case when they wipe out the appellate process?
Well, you know, certainly practitioners in the state have tried to have a certain level of respect for serious crisis and making decisions like this based on the laws of course.
You'd rather stick with stare decisis and strike the whole constitutional amendment than to find a way to make it work constitutionally in terms of the test for equal protection and due process under the U.S. not advance this amendment, even others did, and now we have.
But this court has also been reluctant to read into the Constitution things that are previously there, State Ex Rel Mauer versus Schubert. The court chose not to read additional things into the Constitution that plainly makes the Constitution.
This court is generally reluctant to strike down statutes, so I assume impliedly we would be even more reluctant to strike down constitutional amendments. And so I mean, another pattern of case law is if you can find a way to save it, do it. And it would not be a way to save it, to save it impliedly. We must exercise that way in the process.
Well, even if we can get beyond the way to the other parties, there are certain other differences. For example, in the Court of Appeals is bound by Appellate Rule 12, which mandates that the Court of Appeals review every single issue and set forth in written form the reasons why it is denying a claim. This Court has determined that State versus Poindexter that revised Code 29-2905 does not require that court to do that. So it will be possible that Issue 1 appellants will come to this court without ever having a written decision on all of its issues in the case of the design.
Well, we ought to be able to fix that, too. Let me advance you to what you started out with, and that is the notion that innocent people may somehow run a great risk, and I'll grant you there's going to be some great risk if one or less stop with their case. But the reality of what we see here day in and day out is not very many cases in which counsel stands where you're standing and with a straight face advances the notion that my client didn't do the act. Those cases are, I mean, we see them, but they're not that common. And I have written about residual doubt. Now, isn't that another answer for those of you defending these cases? Try and persuade this court to take a longer look at the concept of residual doubt in terms of whether or not the death penalty ought to be imposed.
Well, I certainly would encourage the court to take a longer look at the residual doubt in several cases, but I don't think that substitutes for a weight of the evidence.
I understand that, but in terms of your argument that an innocent person may go to the chair, that is another mechanism by which to bypass the chair when there's a strong argument presented to the client that they didn't do it.
Yes, I do. And I don't think that I'm just
they get the most review, or does it require that they get a meaningful review?
Well, it requires that they get a meaningful review, but if it's going to pass the equal protection analysis, can't separate out and give less review to the capital defendants than you are giving the non-capital defendants, who have two levels of review, and the capital defendants are left with one. There has to be some sort of reason to have distinguished that class out. And because we are dealing with the death row inmates, you have the additional factors to consider in the Eighth Amendment. It is a full meaningful review to one court the same as a full meaningful review to two. No, I don't think it is.
In view, on that point, in view of the very small number of criminal cases that we accept in our discretionary review authority, there's no data on this, but it seems intuitive to me that most criminal defendants, given the choice of a direct appeal to a court of appeals with a chance of, and not a very good chance, of another review, a second review by the Supreme Court, given that choice versus the guarantee, a right to appeal to the Supreme Court, would probably choose the right to appeal to the Supreme Court, would they not, or is that too speculative for us to even consider?
I think, in a sense, it is speculative, but on the other hand, it still is two levels of review. I hope that when I'm filing my memorandum in support of jurisdiction in this court, which I do many times in our capital post-conviction cases, that this court is actually looking at them and reviewing them.
We do. I can assure you that. So don't let that go by without saying we do.
So in that sense, the fact that you are reviewing them to make a decision to take the case means that they are getting reviewed. So there are two levels of review as opposed to only one level that the death penalty makes again now.
If you're going to use that argument, then you also regulate you individually and the office collectively consistently file motions for rehearing whenever the direct appeals have been turned down or even when we make a final merit decision. You have another review then, do you not? Assuming we're looking at all of this stuff.
But I would do that. If I was doing a memo, so then you're still kind of at the three or two.
But really, what happens is everybody is entitled to a fair trial and one appellate review. Isn't that what our constitutional law has held for years and years and years, all the way back to even the Sixth Amendment?
Well, the Constitution doesn't really provide us with any appeals unless they choose to give them. Obviously, we have a different concern in the capital case is that in order to get beyond the arbitrary and capricious imposition of death penalty, full and meaningful review has always been held and very important. This court held in the first case to come before when it reviewed our two-tier review system.
And hasn't the case law said that means a fair trial and one review?
I don't think the court has ever said one review is enough.
If I find that case saying you're entitled to one appeal, that eliminates your argument then?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. Because I can find it for you.
Because, again, I would go back to you're still left with, we are only going to have that one level of review. We still have to the weight of evidence argument.
Counsel, going back to your weight of evidence argument, the proposition is wrong. That's 13, I believe. You say, they fail to present sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction, or when the conviction is against the weight of the evidence, the conviction cannot stand. In the very brief that you present to us, you ask us to weigh the evidence. I find a rather internal inconsistency with your argument, saying we don't have the right, and then saying, but we would like you to do it in our case.
Well, Your Honor, as I stated when I started this argument, this may be the only appeal that Kenneth can have. I can't afford not to raise any issue before this court. If this court is to find issue one constitutional, and to then do what Justice Pike has proposed, and that is into its duty, weight of the evidence review, I certainly would be remiss if I had not raised that issue to this court.
So following up on Justice Piper's suggestion, the things that the appellate court now do, we certainly could imply from the constitutional amendment as a transfer to our court to do so. There is one full, meaningful appellate review of all the issues
what is this court going to do concerning the requirement of unanimity? If it is going to read into its own power what the Constitution has given the Court of Appeals, that Constitution has told the Court of Appeals you must be unanimous making the decision versus determining the weight of the evidence. The Court is going to then read that into its own power, and we are placed in a position of very different from non-capital defense, and that we will have to prove to all seven of the justices before the Court that the weight of the evidence argument should be approved. And so that certainly places the capital defendant in a much different situation than a place the non-capital defendant would only have to convince three judges, and that we are in a position of meeting a much higher burden than that place on the non-capital defendant to prove to all seven of you that the way of the evidence argument should not be granted.
Counsel, your time's gonna slip away here, and constitutional arguments are extremely important, but since this is Kenneth Smith's only appeal, maybe steer you to tell us why his conviction should be overturned.
Mr. Smith was indicted and convicted of three capital specifications in this case. The aggravated murder occurred during the course of an aggravated robbery, that occurred to escape detection, and that occurred during the course of an aggravated murder of one or two or more persons. In the process of reviewing or in determining this case, the trial court merged the aggravating circumstances. Both the state of Ohio and Kenneth Smith disagree as to how this merger occurred and what should have happened in this case. What the trial court did was it merged all three of the aggravating circumstances into what could only be called a super aggravating circumstance. Because when the jury was instructed what they should consider, the trial court told the jury to consider every single element from all three of the factors. So in other words, he went on that you need to consider that Kenneth Smith committed this aggravated murder to the crime of an aggravated robbery, that he committed it to escape detection, that he committed it as a principal offender, that he committed it in the course of two or more persons.
So there were, was that possible error obviated by the fact that each there was a separate verdict form for each of the for each aggravated circumstance, and the jury had to complete each of those separately and thereby weigh each one individually?
There was a separate form when they determined it in a trial phase.
Yeah.
Phase. When they came to, I'm talking about
penalty phase. You're arguing that.
Right. And they're being told how to weigh the aggravating circumstances of the case versus the mitigating factors. They're on one hand being told by the trial court, there's only one circumstance you should weigh, but it is one, two, three, unless it's all three of the factors. So he combined the factors into a super aggravating circumstance, which is certainly not what this court envisioned when it decided to take versus Jenkins. State versus Jenkins, the defendant came before this court with five aggravating circumstances. This court found that they were duplicated, and it found that only three aggravating circumstances were proper. The other two were not considered then in the weighing process. They more or less disappeared, and then the three factors were considered in the weighing process. Here, what he did was make the one circumstance three times as weighty as if there had only been three circumstances originally. In other words, he did nothing to help nothing in the process of the merger to take the thumb off the debt side of the weighing scale and make sure that the weighing process in this case was appropriate. It really makes a difference in this case because this is a case in which we have an abundance of mitigating evidence. Even if this court is to get to the point of making a determination on the appropriateness, the court must find that the death sentence in this case was not appropriate because of the mitigating evidence that was presented in this case. First of all, we are in a position, unlike any other capital defendant that has come to this court, in that we have a co-defendant who is the defendant's brother. Never before has there been a more similar case before the court. We have not only that the same crime was committed by the co-defendant, but they were raised in the very same factors. And the co-defendant in this case, Randy Smith, is serving a life sentence while my client is on death row. this is incredibly unfair and arbitrary. Both of them were raised in the same chaotic family background, which allowed which resulted in the fact of how they ended up being where they are today. The fact that there was an incredible amount of family substance abuse, the defendant's father was an alcoholic, the substance abuse more or less passed on to the children. Both of the brothers in this case had a severe alcohol problem, a substance abuse problem. Kenny himself started drinking when he was 14 years old, abusing drugs when he was 11 or 12 years old. It was his only way to cope with the tragedies that he had had in his life. In fact, his mother died and brain aneurysm in his presence. And she had been the protector of the family, the one who kept the father from beating them, the one who took them out of the household when the father became violent. And they were then left in this household with this violent alcoholic father. No way to get through their daily lives but to start abusing substance, which they did end up doing. Indeed, Kenny has also suffered from a mild organic brain damage, which had a very great impact on his kids. He cannot deal with stress very effectively. He cannot have trouble in his day-to-day existence, just dealing with the normal day-to-day functioning. He dropped out of school at a very young age. It was also evidence presented that he adapted very well to a prison setting. When he had the structured environment, when the stresses of worrying about where the next meal, his clothes, his house was going to come from, he adapted very well to a prison environment. And indeed, an incredible mitigating factor in this case was the remorse that Mr. Smith showed. He had many times during the course of not only being interviewed by the police officers, but also in his unsworn statement told the jury that he could take his own life to bring back the life of the victims. He will do it in a minute. If the correctly merged aggravating circumstance had been weighed against all of this mitigating evidence, there would have been no choice for the jury to have imposed a life sentence, and there's no choice for the public. This court's final death penalty in this case is inappropriate.
Thank you, Ms. McGarry. Attorney General Montgomery.
States have only one layer of appeal. that's been the appeal since. Has there ever been a case that has ruled that one layer of appeal is insufficient and unconstitutional? I would refer the court to the two cases that were recognized where the states have been challenged in one layer of appeal, and that was expressed by the Court of Ramirez v. Arizona in 1994 and Payne v. Commonwealth in 1994. Ramirez is the case that mirrors Ohio's secure system. And in both of those instances, the courts found the one layer of appeal process, which is judicialized, as you will, to be constitutional. And what is interesting in those instances is that the Supreme Court chose not to grant certiorari. So 25 years later, countless of appeals later, in 25 years, having had no case which challenges the First Amendment as finding the one layer of appeal is unconstitutional.
Ms. Montgomery, let me take you to the issue that took a lot of the time of the appellant, and that is, of course, the authority of this court to weigh evidence under our Ohio Constitution. What is your view of that?
It is the same position, Mr. Chief Justice, that post-issue one, the court now has the authority to weigh the manifest way of the evidence. And why is this really important for this court to consider? First of all, I've done a couple of things. As the current justice questions from the appellant here, is number one, acknowledge the presumption of constitutionality, the heavy burdens that accompany a constitutional amendment and the passage of legislation. And two, it is an interpretation consistent with the past interpretation of this Constitution pre-issue one. If the court will permit, I'll explain that. The Constitution is specifically silent as to the standard, but it is not silent generally on this Supreme Court as to the Supreme Court's jurisdiction for appellate review in general. And the enabling statute, which is passed consistent with Amendment 1, also gives this court the manifest weight jurisdiction. Why is this persuasive? If the court is to look at the way we looked at pre-issue 1 decisions and interpreted the Constitution is also silent on proportionality or weighing the aggravated and mitigating circumstances. Yet this court has done it for years. Why is that? Because of enabling legislation, pre-issue 1, that says to do so. And more recently, in 1991, the state v. Watson, this court has acknowledged that if those subset, that is that legislative enactment, which controls the weighing of proportionality, as well as the manifest weight, aggregated and mitigated circumstances.
How would it work then? One, I can take what you're advancing is not only with the adoption of and the tabling legislation, does this court have the power to write it, but would be required to write it? It's not an option.
Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, you're saying we have to change this, we have the power to, we don't have to. It is clear that the Constitution does not require a manifest weighting of these cases. If one is to look back at Jackson v. Virginia, the floor of constitutionality is a sufficiency standard. And if you are to look frankly at the Constitution's interpretation pre-issue one, even at the Court of Appeals level, see that there is no specific grant of weighing manifest way, even in the Constitution pre-issue one, the Courts of Appeal. There is only an admonition that should you be presented with a manifest way argument, you must. And you decide to rule on this, you must rule in a unanimous fashion. And interestingly enough,
so would we be required to rule in a unanimous fashion on that?
Your Honor, it is the state's position that you would not have to defend the Constitution final. It has no obligation.
So
that
we could or could not, at our option, weigh. And we could determine that four votes makes the call.
It is the state's position, Your Honor, that, in fact, in order to honor the constitutionality of both the amendment and the enabling legislation, consistent with the interpretation of the Constitution, pre-issue one, both the Court of Appeals jurisdiction and Supreme Court decision, that you should weigh the evidence. But should the court decide not to, Fifth Amendment still stands as constitutional because sufficiency of the evidence is standard constitutionally. And finally, to respond to the question, the court is not required because the Constitution is silent.
right to a court of weighing the evidence one way or another in a Supreme Court decision.
Where does the argument come from that we don't have the right to weigh the evidence?
I would be less than honest if I didn't say to this court that this area of the law has been a judicial quagmire for years. If we start with Trumbull, then look at its next case, Robinson, 55, Trumbull, 48, and then up until Ely and Cooley, there was not a discussion that, in fact, we didn't have the authority, you did not have the authority. It was simply you had the authority, but you don't do that.
That's exactly right. And under, as a matter of fact, under 250343, it says we need not weigh the evidence, and that's a civil case procedure. Is there any corollary to that in the criminal law?
The cases since Cooley, Your Honor, have clearly articulated they believe that the Supreme Court does not have the authority. And the beauty of this, of the court's the decision here is that with the passage of the issue one,
do you think Cooley says we do not have or we don't generally do it?
No, Cooley says we do not have the authority. As late as Shoemaker in last session last year said you did not have the authority. The beauty in trying to get out of the judicial quagmire we have is a very difficult area of the law.
What did we base that on?
I'm not aware of what
there's no constitutional provision or statutory provision that you know of that mandates that, is there?
I would admit that, Your Honor, that the Cooey decision and its progeny is difficult to harmonize and explain. If I might, though, to finish this response to Justice Piper, if we look at the Court of Appeals jurisdiction as articulated in the Constitution, and pre-issue one, you'll know that even in the Court of Appeals jurisdiction, it chooses, along with the Court of Appeals decisions directly given in the Constitution, we have enabling legislation. There's no proportionality in these. There's no requirement of weighing the aggravated and mitigated circumstances. The appellants and those that they defended prior to this issue one got that full authority pursuant to statutory authority. It is our position that legislative enactments, those legislative enactments, are simply enabling legislation which does not expand this court's jurisdiction, but rather explains it. If the court will permit, one of the arguments raised in the appellant's brief talks about, says there's, regarding the sufficiency of standards, we don't get the Court of Appeals, but we don't get an adequate review. There is, I would again point out to this court that there is no case law equating the number of appeals with the constitutionality of the system. And to the contrary, as we discussed with the uniformity cases, there is a basket full of cases that said that the state and the ability to set their own system within constitutional guidelines. The Constitution doesn't demand it specifically, and it just is a set of guidelines in which those that system should be set up. I would point out to the court that it seems to me with an ear cocked toward the elephants of Stephen, we should look at the web of procedures that this defendant still has, even if we remove the layer of appeal that is being done at issue one. While the defendant, while forwarding Ohio's legitimate protections that we afford the defendant, not only do we afford protections to the defendant, we also afford the legitimate governmental interests of the state of Ohio. We need to look at the system post-issue one that, in the second language, threatens to devour itself. We know that the defendant gets far more privilege and protections in the first trial, in the trial level, than the non-capital case. And this overweighs, I think, some of the arguments made when you're not getting a fair and full review.
Counsel, since you've opened that issue and that's signed here, but as the Attorney General, you have an opportunity to see an overview of these cases across the state. The ADA recently recommended that states stand down on death penalty until there can be a mechanism in place to ensure greater uniformity and quality of representation. Do we have such a problem in Ohio from your perspective in terms of what you and your office are seeing in review of these cases that perhaps some of these defendants even with the mechanism that we have in place, are not being adequately represented in the initial trial phase.
Justice Spiker, you asked a question which might get several answers that you might think from me. Okay. I have long been an advocate of the public defender system, and I think if we see Rule 65 as well as the kind of cases that you have seen consistently, and I would point out that this court has carefully weighed the evidence, no matter what standard it is used, it is always clearly illuminating what standard will apply, and looked and weighed these cases very carefully. But it seems to me, in answer to your question, that in fact, we have the Rule 65 requirements and the public defender system, we have a very, very credible defense bar handling these cases, and that the defendants get very good representation.
We just saw yesterday a case in which the defendant hired his own counsel, should we have a requirement that you can be protected from making your own independent decision to hire incompetent counsel?
Your Honor, I would indicate that I would not presume to tell this court what to do, but that if Rule 65 would be extended constitutionally to apply to the private bar, require them to be able to be definitely qualified, it can only make the system better. And again, going back to Justice Douglas's comments, expanding on those, they are required to have an adequate and a good defense, but not required to have a perfect defense. If we look back at the system that is now in place, post-issue one, these defendants, with all the layers if we look at the trial layer, when we look at bifurcation, we look at special denial, we look at the requirement of mandated co-counsel in separate cases, when we look at the plethora of afforded these defendants, both as a right and possibility, it is clear that when you start adding up the totals, these defendants have post-issue one, 9 courts that they have available to them, and 41 judges. It is our position, with all due respect to the appellate commission, that in Ohio, many death penalty actions that I quote, if you will, the second case, in Ohio, many death penalty actions are reaching the point of judicial saturation. And in cases presently before us, the criminal justice system has more than satisfied the defendant's constitutional rights of due process and fair trials. Their convictions have been viewed and reviewed. This court has said in Severance, in Ohio, many death penalty actions are reaching the point of judicial saturation. And it would seem to me that in reviewing the layer and the level of procedures that protect these defendants, that in some instances, frankly, do threaten to devour themselves, that this amendment should stand and the enabling legislation should stand because there's a strong presumption of constitutionality that manifest way is the standard of review. And even if this court should decide it isn't, the fallback of sufficiency error is still needs constitutional muster. And frankly, by following the proposal that the state had before you in terms of manifest way, post-issue one, new day, new law, is you don't have to go back and explain, as Justice Douglas has asked me to, the progeny of Frohner and Trudy. You don't have to harmonize. You don't have to comment on it. This is a new day. There are new evidence. There are new standards. And this court can work its way out of the judicial quagmire of the difficulties of these weighing the evidence one way or another. Thank you for
that. General, just before you sit down, I'd like to make one other point. Yesterday we had a case scheduled where your office was the appellee, the state was the appellee. You filed a brief from your office saying the appellant was right, and I thought that your office acquitted itself well in that regard, and I think it ought to be publicly stated. So.
Thank you, Ms. Montgomery. Mr. Eichel.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice Moyer. Attorney General Montgomery has touched upon every part of the issue that's of utmost importance to this court in this case.
say we can't.
Absolutely not.
And that's the point.
Will you address the argument regarding the super aggravated circumstance as opposed to the
In proposition law number two, appellant take the trial court's test to the way it merged the three kinds of specifications at each count. I would submit that appellant made no objection to trial to the instructions as given by the trial court. And in fact, there was one issue raised by the defense, and the defense was requesting that the court, the trial court, merge the three counts. Two deaths involved here, two aggravated murders. He requested all the specifications for both counts to be merged for consideration within one sentence. That's clearly wrong. The court's precedents have clearly said that each count shall be considered separately, and that's what the trial court did in this case. So the objection raised in trial was not well taken by the defense. No objection was raised to the now raised as a super aggravated circumstance. The only objection to trial was from me. The state objected that I raised it on cross appeal so that the issue was not unmarked. That the course of conduct specification, the course of conduct involving the purpose of killing persons, should not in any way, shape, or form have been merged with either the escape protection specification or the aggravated robbery specification in either count. Under this court's analysis, most recently in the State versus Woman's Hall, and going all the way back to the 1990s, the merger of the course of conduct specification at the court that what the trial court was having was wrong. It inured to the benefit of the defense that was merged. It is not implicit, as Wolfensohn's analysis means, it is not implicit in committing an aggravated robbery that you engage in a course of conduct involving two people. That's two purposeful killings. And vice versa, it is not implicit in the course of conduct purposefully killing two people that you engage in an aggravated robbery. The same is true as the escape protection specification.
And counsel, so if I don't misunderstand what you're advancing here, you say the trial judge was wrong in doing this.
The trial judge was wrong specifically in the murder of the course of conduct specification with the other two. This leaves us with the issue that was presented in Jenkins and very many subsequent cases, the State versus Williams in 1995 and even others, whether it was plain error, because it wasn't objective, whether it's plain error for the trial court to, as defense would have it, fail to merge the escape protection and the drug defense. The cases this court started with State versus Williams and most recently my participation in State versus Williams in 1995, the court has held that this error, if error, can be cured by the court's independent review. I would submit that in the independent review and deciding this issue, the court should also consider the propriety, the curative effect that the trial court's instruction that the jury was to consider the quality, not the quantity, of the evidence. The Pope's reply brief criticized the state for making the argument based on their cases that characterized the independent review as waving a magic wand. This is not in any way, shape, or form an accurate description of what this court does on the independent review. Three cases leap out of the State versus Lawrence and State versus Claymore, this court's independent review. A majority of the court found mitigating circumstances in a initial capacity.
citing of those cases makes it very clear that, in addition to other things, we've weighed the evidence. On the residual doubt question, that has to be a weighing of the evidence. And as you say, a majority of the court, some of us don't agree with that concept, but at least that's part of it. What bothers me in this case, more than any one thing, and it's not a very good case to be arguing that we're going to put innocent people to death when we have confessions and all the evidence that we have here. How come you have two people who are clearly jointly implicated? In fact, it might even be difficult to determine who caused the death of either or both of the husband or wife. How come one gets the life sentence and the other gets the death penalty, recognizing that we have said, and I have written, that we only compare for proportionality death penalty cases with death penalty cases? In this case, both of them in the same room at the same time, doing the same acts, and one gets a lesser penalty. How do we square that away in the minds of not only ourselves, but the public?
Well, first of all, going back to your decision to stay for step, there's very clear reasons why this court adopted the policy to step. They're not to review cases for proportionality review that involve a life sentence. Primarily, I believe that the court doesn't have the record of the life sentence case not at all. The court has only had the records of those cases.
Well, what could be different in the life sentence case than was in this case? Because, you know, when they finally got together and the one brother said, well, brother, we better tell because they know. And so they were both there. All the evidence has to be exactly the same, even close to who kicking the lady in the head after she was dead or not dead. What could be different?
I have to be careful of not going outside the record, but based on what's before the court here, there are very distinct differences between the cases.
Okay.
In the attachment to the appendix of the Thomas brief, the court reviewed the conviction entry of Randy's brother.
Mm-hmm.
The jury found that Randy's not guilty of the escape infection specifications of both counts. The state did not charge the indictment, nor did the jury have a prerogative to find that Randy Smith was engaged in aggravated robbery while committing the course of conduct that led to the death of Lewis Randy. This is based on the difference, basically, in the evidence in this case.
I'm not wasting your time with this question because that's what's bothering me about this case and has me on the brink, if you will, on the mitigation stage.
Well,
especially given the other substantial mitigation of mental defect and all of those things that are in the mitigation stage in this defendant.
Well, I'd like the court to consider this. The confession of Kenneth Smith was not in evidence in Randy's case. The confession of Kenneth Smith is rank hearsay as regarding the trial of Randy Smith. Kenneth Smith's custodial confession to having killed both Mr. and Mrs. Ray to keep them from telling and scoping it while planning the crime back to Crystal Bar before the incompetent car to go there. Prior calculation and design and evidence of the escape detection specification. That confession is rank hearsay and was not admissible in Randy's
It still does not negate the principal offender issue. It doesn't have to be prior calculation design to show the principal offender.
That's correct. Another difference, going to the principal offender aspect of the case, Kenny Smith was the principal offender in the death of Lewis Ray. Randy was the principal offender in the other.
Counsel, with our two members in the same issue, let me pursue it from a slightly different tack. I think I know the answer to what you said. I'm not even sure. You did against both. Because sometimes we see cases in which you cut a deal with one defendant and go after the death penalty on the other when it's hard to distinguish the much degree of difference in the facts. But here you did pursue both and go, the case went to a jury.
Yes.
And you're asking for the same penalty in both.
Yes. And that eliminates the concern Your Honor had in the dissenting opinion in the brief. The plea bargain struck one together in the brief. We don't have that disparity in prosecution.
So that concern that I've articulated on my part is not present in this case. And I take it also in your answers to Justice Douglas that while some of it may be outside the record, you regard the level of proof or what you had to offer in prosecuting the case against the other defendant as being inferior to what you had in this case.
Yes. Not only was this custodial confession not admissible, but the statements that Kenneth Smith made to witness James Baker, his friend at the time, those were admissions to Baker that he hit Lewis Gray between the eyes with a hammer, that he winked at Brandy and pulled him. That was his signal to go in and strangle Lewis Gray. His laughter about it when he's going through the jewelry on the floor of the Baker home. Laughter about how he's going to commit these crimes. So he won his.
For me, that brings me back to the part where you acknowledge the trial judge made a mistake. You argue, you objected to that mistake and the defense counsel did not. And you, it is your belief that that mistake hurt you and helped the defendant rather than the other way around.
Correct.
You hurt the state. The state.
The state I objected to more to the benefit of the defendant as opposed to.
But the defendant says, no, it hurt me.
Well.
That's the reason I'm going to the chair.
If the error was in an improper merger, that would only benefit the state. I raised the issue solely because these courts want to conduct this independent review, and there definitely are more than one specifications as to meeting balance case. Not that number means anything. As the trial judge said, and as this court said in Penix, striking out an opposite jury instruction, Penix was reversed because the court declared the trial court's instruction wrong. Trial court said you shall consider the quantity of the aggravating circumstances. If one of them was bad, the gun specification should not be considered. The jury was explicitly told to consider the quantity of the specifications. This court in Jenkins, very first case, close to 1981. This court said that we're not looking at quantity, we're looking at quality of the evidence. So no jury instruction was given in Jenkins to tell the jury to consider quantity.
That's
why the independent review before the error.
Let me take you aside a little bit into the area of Justice Douglas' development, and that is the proportionality review. And we have this line of cases saying we're only looking for death cases, but do we have it right, and particularly now that this procedure is upheld, it all comes directly to us. Should we only be looking at death cases, or should we be looking at all cases in which capital punishment could have been sought at the first instance to determine whether or not there is any invidious discrimination on race or any other basis? Are we getting the proper? Do we have it in focus if we're just looking at
well,
the
capital cases, or do we need to start with a bigger picture in order to do that?
This case here probably doesn't present an appropriate vehicle for overruling.
I realize that.
The reason I say that, go back to Lockett versus Ohio, the Supreme Court of the United States demands capital litigation that we consider the individual.
I'm asking, in your role as a prosecutor,
yes.
Is our focus too narrow to get that question right, or is it appropriate to be that now?
I think it's appropriate to follow the step and reaffirm this on that basis. Getting to points about what individuals determination of sentence is what Locke is all about. We have two brothers, granted, but they are two individuals. They are not even identical. They are not identical in their backgrounds.
What's the difference in mitigation presented in the two cases?
I can only speak to the opinion filed by Judge Trowler State in this court following the life sentence. He said there was profound remorse found by the jury. He said that, well, first of all, there aren't the same number and the quality of the evidence on the specifications are different. Outline there. All the brand hearsay that shows Kenny Smith's statements to his friend Baker and to his police is not the same as the confession made.
I'm talking more about the life of the two boys rather than that the evidence is that you've covered that. What about the
lives of the two? You'll find in Judge State's opinion about this court that. Randy Smith made an unsworn statement and indicated that this was robbery was basically all Kenny's idea that he was a follower as opposed to the act of instigating. It was Kenny Smith's idea. You also find in the mitigating factors that the judge states and in the psychological problems that Ransom had arose in part from physical and mental abuse occasioned by Kenneth Smith, his brother. That strikes me as a huge difference between these cases. Who was the abuser versus who was the abused? Randy also indicated that in those states, the father did not abuse Kenneth Smith. He abused Randy Smith, not only physically.
How about mental defect, and how about prior criminal record, and how about age, and how about the other five factors? And
well, Randy was older than
yes.
Older brother. Criminal records are somewhat similar, so both spent time in prison. That's why. As far as psychological problems, I believe the judge states and many would indicate pronounced differences. Of course, the individual is going to have a different psychological makeup than another. They may live in the same house, but they're different people.
To go back to the Stuffit issue for a minute, because I think you. And I think reacted properly when you said, oh, don't do anything with Stuffit. The reason Stefan was written the way it was, and I wrote Stefan, is because I wrote the first case in the Court of Appeals on the death penalty case, on the death penalty statute. It's a new statute, 1984. And every week while that case was pending, after oral argument, we'd have something else filed with us in the court, coming out of the grand jury that these people had committed aggravated murder but were not given a death penalty specification. And if we take the universe of cases, then we would never get to ultimate judgment in these cases. And that was really what was in my mind when I was writing stuff.
Thank you, Jenkins, for that. This court's decision, Jenkins, I guess, the Court of Appeals decision on that score.
Yeah, Jenkins and Rogers were parallel.
Yes. conclude by reminding the court that the record in this case shows evidence of guilt and aggravating circumstances that is as overwhelming as some of the other decisions of this court. In other cases, notably coming to my mind, State versus Lowe, where there is a confession, all elements of the aggravating circumstances involved. We have rather meager. The evidence of mitigation, the remorse rebutted by putting the gloves or the stockings on his hand and going through the house to burglarize after he spilled his laughter, going for jewelry, all that taking place before his arrest, makes the later findings 8 months later somewhat dissipated.
Thank you, Mr. Eichel. Ms. McGarry, you've saved a little over 7 minutes of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would encourage this court to review the decision probably that the state actually did read concerning mitigating factors, because some of the representations that the state has made are not accurate. Judge Sage, in his trial court opinion, indicated that Raleigh more than admitted that it was a mutual plan between the two of them, and it wasn't that Kenny was the mastermind. That Raleigh Smith was only supposed to keep Mrs. Ray busy, and then he went on and killed her. And now that he has killed Ruth Ray, he is receiving a life sentence for that, and my claim is on death row. I think there were a lot of differences in the mitigating evidence that was presented in the cases. One of the very compelling factors was what Justice Douglas pointed out, the organic brain damage that Kenny Smith suffered under. Certainly the incredible amount of drinking. And I think one of the things that Mr. Eichel has just indicated to you is that he shouldn't be entitled to the remorse factor because of things that happened during the course of the crime.
So you would have us turn down the death penalty on the basis of proportionality or on the basis of the error of the turkey?
I believe either of those options is turned down.
Take your choice,
Both.
I assume you want to win, but and a win here is not to overturn the conviction, but to overturn the death penalty for you in terms of how you advance this argument. So let me back you up then to the proportionality question. Is it your view that proportionality review would come in play when the prosecutor has made his or her best effort to present the case in both of these companion cases to they don't hold back, lay down, roll over, but go after the same penalty in both where that appears to them to be appropriate, and the jury in one case arrives at one conclusion and arrives at a different. The other one that we should say that's disproportional application.
That has always been our position, that is just one of those circumstances where it even makes more consider proportionality. What I would also say to the court is that even if this court decides it cannot or does not want to overrule the staff's decision, it does not want to consider the life verdict that Raleigh Smith in proportionality review, it can consider the life verdict as a mitigating factor under A7. The United States Supreme Court has so held in Harper versus Duggar.
Okay. Well, I want to stay with that just a little bit because maybe I have a wrong conception of proportionality, because I thought that part of the statute was to deal with an unfairness on the part of the state in attempting to apply the statute even-handedly. My question presumes, and the facts here seem to indicate, that the state was as even-handed as you could get. I
I don't understand from this fact situation how you could ask the state to be more even-handed in the way they attempted to apply the death penalty statute to these two defendants. Am I wrong in that perception?
I believe if you look at what 29-2905 requires courts to do in the proportionality review and to look at similar cases, it doesn't really explain beyond that what the similarities need to be as far as do they need to be the thing that you have just set out to us as far as it have to be.
Well, I guess my question applies is you seem to be taking one step further and would require that different juries made up of different citizens reach the same result in similar fact patterns. And that seems to me to be a step beyond the purpose of what proportionality review is about. Help me out. I thought proportionality was to make sure that you don't have prosecutors treating minorities unfairly or treating women unfairly, or treating any subgroup in our population, or prosecutor in Butler County and prosecutor in Stark County having a totally different way that they go about it, determining which cases do we seek the death penalty to achieve uniformity and what's the threshold for.
I think that all requires proportionality, but I think one of the intents of proportionality is also to ensure that the death penalty is not imposed in an arbitrary and capricious manner. And I think that this is a perfect example of how the death penalty can be imposed in an arbitrary and capricious manner when someone who actually kills the victim gets life and the person who didn't gets death. I think it's a perfect example of why we have proportionality aspect of our statute there. The arguments the Attorney General made concerning issue one, I don't believe that the court can just look at statistics or figures saying, well, there are 30-some states out there that have single-tiered review, and so that's fine. I think that you have to look at the statute, some of the cases that you have to look at them, you realize there are very big differences in the state itself. For example, one of the states that, or one of the cases the state has cited saying directly on point, is very, very different because they have provided their capital defendants more process because they have their direct appeal to their Supreme Court, while their non-capital cases have only a discretionary appeal to their courts of appeal. So that is not the exact same situation that we have here. And so what we need to do is look at our state, what our state provides non-capital defendants and what our state provides capital defendants to determine whether or not that violates equal protection. The public bloodlust for execution is one of the strongest arguments that orderly process of law and due deliberation and review of the death sentences and a restraint from judgment, or a rush to judgment. When this court in the state of Ohio found that two tiers of compelled review were appropriate, nothing has happened to change that. Is it no longer appropriate because it takes too long? Well, this case is also about issue one. It's also about Kenny Smith, who sits on death row, while his equally culpable brother serving a life sentence. The purpose of providing an appeal to a capital defense defendant is to guard against arbitrary and capricious imposition of the death penalty. This is one of those cases. Does the appeals process work in the state of Ohio? If it does, then the death sentence in this case will be vacated.
Thank you, Ms. McGarry. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.